Hi there, it's Ben from World Have Your Say. This is a download from the BBC. If you want to read our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts. Here's today's programme.
We've heard the news from the BBC.
Now it's your turn.
Yo, you can join the conversation anywhere you want it. On the blog, on Twitter, Facebook, or worldhaveyoursay.com.
Welcome to World Have Your Say.
Hello there. Here are some of the headlines of opinion pieces you've been reading and sharing over the last 24, 48 hours, discussing the possible origin of the bombs in Boston and also what might happen in America when the bomber's identity is revealed. On Salon.com, the headline, "Let's hope the Boston Marathon bomber is a white American." On the Daily Beast, "Praying the Boston bomber is not Muslim." And one of the most read pieces on Al Jazeera today, "Boston explosions. Please don't be Arabs or Muslims." Do the implications of who carried out the bombings matter to you? And do you think they matter to America? We've got some of the authors of these pieces coming up to talk to each other and to you. And later, after some comments from you saying coverage of this story has been excessive, we'll talk to people in other places around the world where people have died violently this week. How do they feel about the greater prominence of Boston in the news? I'm Ben James. As you listen, you can talk on the Twitter hashtag WHYS or at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay.
I'm Ayuna Wan from South Sudan, and this is BBC World of USA. To take part in this live debate, call country code 4420-3162-4242.
And don't forget, you can also email us to worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com. Send us your number if you like and we can call you straight back to get you involved in this discussion. Right, let me introduce you to a couple of people who wrote the pieces of which the headlines I just read you. David Sirota is a nationally syndicated columnist and contributor to Salon.com. Welcome, David, to World Have Your Say.
Thanks for having me.
And Khaled Beydoun is a critical race studies fellow at UCLA School of Law in California and wrote the aforementioned piece on aljazeera.com. Hello, Khaled. Welcome to the programme. David, just start then by taking us through your argument, I guess, what you were saying in your piece.
Well, the basic point is that in the United States, we tend to react to terrorist threats in a different way based on the differences in the accused and often convicted terrorists. So the only point I was trying to make was that the identity of the assailant, and let's pray that the assailant is found or assailants are found, the identity of the assailant is important demographically speaking, because that, as our history has shown, has a connection to how the United States reacts in a long-term systemic way to a terrorist attack. We don't tend to react in a systemic, militarized way when a terrorist attack happens at the hands of typically a white male domestic terrorist, a white male, oftentimes anti-government terrorist. We certainly don't react with the same force, with the same military involvement that we do when we are faced with a terrorist attack from an assailant who is a Muslim or a foreigner. Even Bill O'Reilly, conservative Bill O'Reilly on Fox News yesterday, said that if we find that the assailant is foreigner or international terrorism, the reaction will be severe. But if we find that it's a homegrown terrorist, it will simply just be another stain on American history. And so the only point I'm trying to make is that we should be asking ourselves the question of why we react so differently to terrorism based on the identity, the specific identity of the terrorist, rather than the scope of the terrorist attack itself.
And Khaled, come in here, because you were talking in your piece about your own reaction when hearing of the news of the Boston bombings. Just explain that to those people who've not read your piece.
Yeah, so my piece kind of diverges from, you know, many of the pieces that have been written on the subject matter thus far. For me, I was really trying to construct a subjective piece that, you know, that sought to capture, you know, kind of the collective psychological existential, you know, perspective of Arab and Muslim Americans while things were happening in real time. You know, for members of my community, the initial and immediate reaction was, you know, kind of the thought and the prayer that the individual who was identified or suspected of being the culprit was neither Arab or Muslim, you know, for fear of many of the things David said, for fear, you know, of an immediate backlash, for fear of, you know, the public violence that, you know, is well memorable post 9/11, immediately after Oklahoma City. you know, various string of domestic terrorist attacks where individuals who were Arab and Muslim were immediately thought to be, you know, the culprits of those attacks. So I really wanted to capture kind of the collective consciousness of both Arab and Muslim Americans at the time, you know, and I can tell you that it was pretty much consensus and, you know, based on the residents of my piece that individuals were collectively holding their breath, hoping that the individual who was identified was neither Arab or Muslim.
And just take us back to that time for yourself as a Muslim American. Did you experience that directly yourself after 9/11?
Yeah, so, you know, my position is kind of unique in the sense that, you know, I come from Detroit, which is the most concentrated Arab and Muslim American community in the country. At the time, I was beginning my first year of law school on the West Coast. 9/11 had unfolded 2 weeks into my first year of law school. I remember very vividly, you know, the hate mongering, the random acts of violence on the ground that I faced. And if you were to see me, I'm not the most conspicuous looking Muslim or Arab by any means. You know, I'm profiled generally as being Latino, but just, you know, really recollecting the experiences friends had, you know, family, especially given that my community is very concentrated, in terms of it being Arab and Muslim. So that, you know, that kind of colors the immediate reaction our communities have during times, like right now with what's unfolding in Boston, is that, you know, we know all too well the kind of response, we know all too well the kind of reactions that arise even before, you know, it's resolved that the culprit is in fact of a certain, you know, demographic or ethnic makeup. So I definitely echo what David's saying. But again, my piece was really trying to, you know, really illustrate, you know, for kind of in the first time, I believe, what the perspective of our, you know, of my communities was as these events unfolded.
And if you're listening, you've written, if you've read any of the pieces that our guests have written, we'll be posting them and tweeting them as well during the programme. Then, you know, get in touch with us, facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. If you'd like to put any points or questions to the guests on air or get involved in this discussion, facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. J.M. Berger's with us as well, live from Cambridge, Massachusetts. You've written something called What Extremists Are Saying About the Boston Massacre on Foreign Policy. JM, welcome. And also welcome to Amy Davidson, who's written on The New Yorker about this subject. And I'm keen for the four of you to talk this through. Amy, why don't you kick us off here and just address this conversation about how it would matter to America what the origin of this bomb attack might be.
All right, thanks. I looking at the moments and the hours after the bombing, I was really struck by a contrast. The marathon was a scene at the end of just incredible kindness and generosity, and people who were tearing their clothes to make tourniquets, runners who were running then to give blood, and people who were just helping complete strangers in this complete selfless way. And in the midst of that, there was this story of one of the victims of the bombing, a 20-year-old man who was injured, who had a very different reaction to him. CBS reported that somebody thought he looked suspicious and tackled him. There were reports immediately that on the New York Post that a Saudi suspect had been taken into custody, that his hospital bed where he was lying, again, to recover from injuries that were inflicted in this bombing, was being guarded. And this story raced around that there was a Saudi suspect, and his apartment was searched, his belongings were carried out. There was a big show of force there. And that seemed like a troubling question to ask. Why in a crowd where everyone was running away from a bombing, why did people see one man who was running away just like everybody else was differently? Why did they see him as suspicious? And there isn't really a good or a fair answer to that. He was a Saudi Arabian man who was 20, who was in the U.S. to study. There was a sort of fever about this news of a Saudi suspect that sort of raced around the web that took more than a day to really break. But, you know, by the time law enforcement officials said, you know, no, we've checked him out, we've cleared him, he's fine. But by then, he'd been written about. His name was on the web as he was called a jihadi. It just was not a fine moment. And again, on a day when there were so many really inspiring reactions from strangers helping other strangers. And it just, I wondered what was missing in the American reaction.
I'd like to.
If I could chime in really quickly, I think what's really concerning about the context in Boston is that, you know, Boston hosts, I think, the biggest community of international students from the Arab world. I think the biggest contingent of Saudi students actually live in Boston. So, you know, I think just kind of the collateral effect moving forward is that the dragnet, you know, the monitoring suspicion of students who are there, you know, legally studying, is going to be really frightening moving forward.
Well, let's keep in mind that one of the three victims who died, Lu Lingji, was a Chinese graduate student who was in Boston to study statistics. It was a very, and this is such an international event as well. So it was very normal for there to be people who were an American there. It's a moment where we need to be most cautious about how we're reacting to people. And it seemed that especially some of the media reaction to the news of this young man was not cautious, to say the least.
JM, you were trying to come in there, I think.
Yeah, thank you. I think that, you know, this is a very important issue that is really legitimate to talk about. I think that the framing of the Salon article was pretty unfortunate, wishing for a white male suspect. You know, I think rooting for a perpetrator who fits some sort of perception of what you think is best is kind of counterproductive. We should be waiting to find out who the perpetrator is. I'd also point out that, you know, we have a problem here with domestic jihadists, and they are not all Arab by any stretch of the imagination. I think we're getting, you know, when we get into these conversations before we have information, we're getting ahead of ourselves, and we're creating an atmosphere where some of these, you know, things that happened, and the unfortunate incident with the Saudi student, which was really appalling, I thought, you know, I think we're just inviting the problem. And, you know, the other issue here is everybody's treating this as kind of a binary situation where it's either the right wing of the United States extremist community or it's a jihadist of some sort. And in fact, there are a lot of other options. It could be a psychopath. It could be a estranged husband. It could be one of any number of left-wing extremist groups that are active in this country. So, I mean, I think we really have to try, and I know it's difficult. There's a lot of pressure for everybody to really try and want to know what's going on here and who's behind this. And, you know, there are reasons why we want to know who's behind this, but, you know, we don't. And we're getting ahead of ourselves in a lot of this.
And Amy, I can hear you trying to come in there, but also, David, I should let you respond to JM's criticism of the way that your piece is framed. Go ahead and talk to him.
Yeah, well, the criticism sounds like somebody who doesn't want to talk about these issues, and that's frankly a position of privilege to say that we shouldn't talk about these issues, that we shouldn't worry about these kinds of things. The reason I think that we should hope for you had your chance, now you'll let me have mine. The reason I think we should hope that the bomber is a white person is because we know our government is prone to not overreact when terrorism comes at the hands of white people, but that our government is prone to overreact when it comes at the hands of people of color and Muslims in particular. And my point is, you can be a white person and believe that. If you're a white person who believes in civil liberties, if you're a white person who doesn't like the Iraq and Afghanistan war, if you're a white person who doesn't like us overspending on the Pentagon, then you probably should want the bomber to, when we hopefully find him or her, to be a white person, because if the person isn't a white person, there's a long history in the United States of us using that person's identity to encroach on civil liberties, start wars, overspend on the Pentagon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I just need to respond to this. When a terrorist attack happens on U.S. soil, there have been a number of attacks and attempted attacks that have involved people with a jihadist ideology, and they have not prompted a military response when they happen here and can be handled as a law enforcement. When there's an overseas component, we can't arrest somebody who's in Somalia, who's in Pakistan, you know.
You mean like 9/11? Like 9/11? I mean, 9/11 was an assault on our country.
Hang on one second, David. Let's just let JM finish. Let JM finish, please. Go on, JM.
9/11 originated overseas, and we did not have a option to arrest Osama bin Laden, so we took military action. I mean, you can't. It's not the nature of the person; it's the nature of how.
And hang on, let's just all please just hang on one second, because we should all, of course, speak one at a time, so we can hear what all of you are saying. Because you've all got very interesting points to make here. Amy, you've been trying to get in a number of times there, so go ahead and respond to the exchange you've just heard, and then by all means, Khaled, you come in after Amy.
Well, I would just push back a little and say, why do we have to accept that that's what the reaction has been, and that the energy should be put not into hoping that it's one perpetrator or the other, but to saying no matter who the perpetrator is, let's drive the response in a certain direction and confront it so that it doesn't have to be that choice. And again, it is true. It doesn't have to be either Arab American or foreign or, you know, right-wing militia guys. It could be somebody who's Icelandic, just to pick a random nationality. But I don't want to live in a country where I'm hoping that the perpetrator of a terrorist act is of one ethnicity or the other. I want to make sure that, you know, even if it was a Saudi who set this bomb, this young Saudi man shouldn't have been treated that way. And I don't want to sort of just sit back. And David, it's not so much a criticism as wondering whether one can't be more ambitious and say we are not going to hope. We're going to hope that no matter who the perpetrator is, this time maybe we can get it right.
Well, I completely agree with that. And what I would add is this. We will never get to that point. We will never get to what you and I commonly agree on unless we actually have a frank discussion in this country about how the politics of privilege impact national security policymaking. And the politics of privilege in the world that we live in now is not a colorblind, not an ethnicity-blind politics. It is a politics that dictates different kinds of reactions based specifically on the ethnicity and religion of those who are the perpetrators.
I'm just saying that I'm not sure that you all disagree as much as you might think. I think that what people are reacting to is that nobody should ever be told, hope that this criminal doesn't look like you. You know, I also think that, you know, some of the best sources for leads and things like that can come from within communities. You know, communities that care about the safety of the country as much as anybody. And, you know, the idea of just like keep your head down doesn't feel very American to me.
Khaled, come in there because you were trying to make a point.
I think we're talking about these different, you know, ideas kind of, you know, at a very top level. And I'd like to put a human face on everything we're discussing. So I'm Arab American. I'm Muslim American. My name is Khaled Ali Baydoun. I'm also very American, right? So what typically happens when I'm trying to mourn and grieve and, you know, kind of partake in the general American process of, you know, showing grievance to what's happening is if I attend a rally or a protest with my mom who might wear a scarf or a veil, you know, what happens? We're American, right? But we're immediately suspected for being involved with some sort of collective movement which has, you know, brought forth some kind of violence on America at large. So what really happens in real time is that when, you know, there is an attempt on our part to, you know, demonstrate that we are part of the American process of mourning, that we're immediately, you know, kind of suspected as being, you know, part of the menace, you know, part of this movement that's bringing forth, you know, violence on American soil. So, I appreciate what I'm sorry, I don't know what your name is. The lone lady on the forum is saying. However,
that's Amy.
It's tough to be ambitious. It's tough to kind of, you know, think in those optimistic terms when on the ground in real time.
Absolutely. You know,
That colorblind romantic notion of America is not what's taking place. So I really have to echo David's point.
Let me read you a couple of comments coming into us at World Have Your Say at facebook.com/World Have Your Say from people as they've been listening to you. David is in Chicago saying if they're white Americans, we'll do a lot of talking and essentially nothing more. Pam is also somewhere in the US. I'm from the US. She says, I don't care where the bomber is from. They're terrorizing people. You're listening to World Have Your Say on the BBC. And the four of you, let me introduce you to a fifth guest. Haider is live with us from Boston. Haider Warach, who you wrote an article in The New Yorker called Living Through Terror in Rawalpindi and Boston. Welcome to the programme. What's the point you'd like to make on this?
Thank you for having me on the show, Ben. I've been listening to the conversation, and as you can imagine, this is something that elicits strong reactions. I'm a resident in medicine in one of the teaching hospitals here in Boston, and I was actually pretty close to the events as they unfolded, and I didn't realize what had happened. I was with my wife at that point. We actually first thought that there was some sort of shooting. But after the initial sort of fear and after we sort of got out of that closed space, which is pretty much yards away from the second bomb, then I started to think, then all these ideas started to come in my head as I started to sort of get come together and realize that I was not only a victim, but I was also a potential suspect. So as you see, I'm a young 20-something-year-old male. I had a dark double at that point. I wasn't wearing a backpack, but that wouldn't have gotten me any extra either. And I'm Pakistani, and I speak with a Pakistani accent. And now that this whole episode of this poor Saudi boy has unfolded, had I been closer to the bomb, I could have been in that situation. I can totally see myself in that situation now, something that I didn't realize even when I wrote the article, because this story was still unfolding. So I think that what my sort of additional perspective to what has already been said is that on a day-to-day basis, I think my interaction with Americans, I take care of them. I take care of them at the end of life, at the beginning of life, during good and bad. I rarely am the target of xenophobia or any sort of discrimination. But I think these sort of events, the events that unfolded in, at the end of the marathon, bring out both the best as well as the worst in people. The best was demonstrated by the sort of work that people were doing, helping out, as Amy had mentioned, but also the worst, and it elicits the sort of fear that people have that they at other times would not sort of bring to the fore.
Well, Haider, your experience is fascinating, and there's obviously lots more to say on this. So what we're going to do is, if we can, with those of you joining us, take this through to just the other side of the news headlines, because I'd love to hear the response of our other guests, your experience there, Haider, in Boston. So, look, thanks for the moment. We'll come back. I just want to read you this. The Reuters news agency is bringing reports from CNN and also the Boston Globe reporting and citing an unnamed source that investigators into the Boston Marathon bomb believe that they've identified a suspect from security video taken before the blasts that show a man depositing a bag on the street where one of the explosions took place and then walking away. It's an unverified report by the BBC, and Reuters unable to confirm it, but that's what CNN and the Boston Globe saying at the moment. We'll check that out and we'll bring you any more news on that when we can.
We've heard the news from the BBC. Now it's your turn.
You can post on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay
or get in touch via Twitter at @BBC_WHYS.
Welcome to World Have Your Say.
So on the possible identity of the Boston bomber, Sean in Washington State posted on Facebook to say, it doesn't matter to me whether or not the terrorist was domestic or foreign, but it will matter to the US community as a whole. It's easier to fear something which we can't control, i.e. international terror groups, versus our own population. Ben on in Uganda's got a point to make on this too on Facebook. Of course it matters, he says. If the bomber's American, then maybe Obama will bring the troops back home to hunt for the terrorists at home. We're also going to talk about the media coverage too, because we've had a number of messages like this from Nathaniel in Nigeria, who says the unnecessary attention allotted to the Boston attack by the media at the expense of more dangerous attacks in other parts of the world has got my nerves cracking. Well, Nathaniel, we're going to speak to people in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Syria and Iraq in the next half hour to hear their stories and how they feel about the coverage. I'm Ben James. You can post on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay to get involved.
If you don't want to make an international call, text country code 44778620608 and put call me in your message.
And just before the news, we were hearing from Haider, who's a Pakistani in Boston at the moment, and he was explaining his experiences in the aftermath of the attack in Boston. Khaled Beydoun is still with us. He wrote a piece on Al Jazeera, partly headlined, "Please don't be Arabs or Muslims," when talking about this attack. Khaled, I'm wondering if you want to pick up from Haider, and I guess his experience is something that you can relate to or something that you can see being discussed elsewhere too.
Yeah, definitely. I can definitely echo Haider's experience. I mean, obviously, circle 9/11, circle Oklahoma City, and obviously with what's unfolding today. I think one distinction I'd like to make is that it's kind of like overarching our conversation is the binary between collective guilt and individual guilt. And typically what happens when the individual is either Arab or Muslim is that the entire collective of, you know, Arab and Muslim Americans are vilified, and that's the process. However, you know, as David has said, if the individual is white, and I definitely share his hope that the culprit is white, because what typically happens is that the process is it's framed as a deviant individual act, and we saw that with you know, a range of previous domestic attacks. We saw that obviously in Aurora. We saw that obviously with the attack on the Sikh temple in Wisconsin. So that's the real distinction: is that if it's a white culprit, white people at large aren't vilified and punished. However, if it's an Arab and Muslim culprit, the entire collective of both communities is punished. And that's the real distinction. Another point I'd like to make is that one gentleman framed an idea as a jihadi ideology. There is no such thing as a jihadi ideology. You know, I've studied Sharia law closely. I'm Muslim American. And that's the problem, is that you have these polemic positions with really which really resonate in the media, that individuals, you know, spew myths about Islam that are caricatures and so forth, that really brew the kind of racism and xenophobia and Islamophobia that prevails today.
Well, thanks for responding to that, Khaled. Thanks, by the way, to David Sirota and to J.M. Berger, both of whom have had to go. But Amy Davidson is still with us, who wrote a piece on this on The New Yorker. And the three of you, Haider, you're still there too in Boston. Can I read you this exchange we've had on our Facebook page, both from Floridians? Lynn is there saying, if it happens to be a non-minority in this country, the right wing will scream conspiracy. Dave in Florida posts, if it happens to be a minority, the left will scream racist law enforcement. Both using the word scream there, Amy. I'm wondering, we've talked about the tone of political debate as well before in America on this programme. Is there too much screaming, and is that part of the problem?
There is too much screaming. This is what I hope. I hope that they catch whoever did it. And I'm not sort of putting my, you know, my chips down on anyone yet. I understand now that there are a lot of leads. I think everybody hopes that they catch whoever did it. And I think that we should then look at who that is in terms of the evidence against that person. And that's what we've just got to stick to and not sort of, you know, be placing our bets, because what your commentator there said was so right, that there's what we've really got to fight against is the tendency to see a suspect, especially a non-white suspect, and say that implicates this group or that group. It doesn't. It doesn't implicate that group. And it's just something we've got to really hold on to, if we can.
Let me bring in Hamad Moses Khan as well, who has written on Huffington Post an article, Seeing Muslims Trending Hurts. And that, of course, happened on Twitter soon after the Boston bombings. Hi, Hamad. Welcome to the programme. How do you feel about the tone of the debate and how that might contribute to how this might be treated, whoever it might be?
I think one thing I wanted to bring in is that I think we need to step back a little. There's a lot of conversation about, will this be an Arab Muslim? Will this be a South Asian Muslim? Or will this be somebody from a Caucasian descent? I think we need to step back, and as we were just talking about, look at the kind of the forces that play into this. Instead of, you know, things would get better if this was a Caucasian person, we need to look at the things that make it worse if they were Arab. We need to address some of those issues. I think one of the great highlights that we had coming out of this was the Islamic Society of Boston doing a press release soon afterwards, offering their services to anyone in the community, whether they needed a place to live, whether they needed a place to as a community shelter. And they had 40 doctors from that community stepping up and offering their services to the community. And I think as an American Muslim community, being an American Muslim, I feel like that's our steps forward to kind of dealing with this. I don't know if our condition or our kind of status in the media right now is going to be improved simply by this being a Caucasian person. That doesn't solve any of the issues that we face. While us going out there making ourselves a resource for our communities is going to do a lot more good in the long run.
I think that's right. I think it makes sense to recognize that this has been in the past an American weakness, and to really address it on that level to make sure it doesn't happen in the bad way again.
Okay, if I can make a couple of points, is that, you know, history provides the best evidence. So if we go back in time and we do a survey of all the terrorist attacks that were you know, conducted by white Americans, let's see what the follow-up was, right? So Oklahoma City, go back to Oklahoma City in 1995, Timothy McVeigh, Michigan Militia, a white supremacist organization. What was the fallout after that, right? Does anybody remember? It was the Anti-Terrorism and Death Penalty Act. It was legislation, very sweeping legislation, that despite the identity of the terrorists, this was legislation that pretty much enabled federal police forces to racially profile Arab and Muslims. What happened after Aurora, which was, you know, again, a white terrorist? Was there any sweeping legislation or any kind of, like, collective punishment for white Americans? No. That only happens when it's an individual who's either Arab or Muslim or brown, which tells me that the real reality is that terrorism has a specific racial and religious anatomy. So we can idealize, we can theorize, we can romanticize about a colorblind America and be very optimistic. But however, I think what we really clearly have to do is to look back toward history and see what really happens in real time when the terrorist is of a specific ethnic or religious or racial makeup.
Okay, Halle, thank you very much. I just have to jump in there because we need to move on, because lots of people want to talk about another aspect of this story. But Khaled and Amy and all of our other guests, Haider as well there was with us, and thanks so much. Hamad, you're going to stick around to talk with us on the media coverage angle of this. And, well, lots of you have been getting in touch, lots of people talking to us on our Facebook page. I think the majority of people getting in touch on that page over the last hours have been talking about how, in your view, you feel the coverage is excessive when weighed against other violent deaths in the last few days in countries around the world. Here are some of your comments. Adnan's in Scotland, for example, saying, "My heart goes out to all the victims of the Boston bombings. Many people lost their lives in Iran and Pakistan after the earthquake that struck the region, and yet only minimum coverage was given to that news." David in Lusaka puts another point. "It's rare for a bomb to go off in Boston, so no wonder there's the coverage. Some places where bombings occur are in conflict zones and everyone knows it." Well, we did start discussing this aspect of the story in our early programme at 10:30 GMT. We had the editor of BBC Arabic, Edgar Jellard, and the head of World Service News in English, Andrew Whitehead. They gave their response to the reporting and also whether the scale of the coverage would change once the motivation of the bomber was known.
Yes, because news is in part about being taken by surprise. So the familiar, however terrible, does not make news in the same way as things which take you by surprise. That's just the business that we're in. So if there is an element to this which surprises, then it will make it more of a story. But to be honest, if there is a definitive lead about who was responsible for these attacks, that will be a very big story, whoever it turns out to be.
Yeah, exactly. The first minutes after the blast, we wanted to report the news. But later on, we wanted to start speculations about who did it. And we have to answer this question. That's why the story was still fresh all the way till President Obama gave his speech, when we understood that even President Obama doesn't know what's happening. Then the story started to die down. And then now, when we know who did it, or we have clues about the investigations, then the story will go up again.
That's Edgar Jellard from BBC Arabic. Before him, BBC World Service's Andrew Whitehead. Now, on Monday in Iraq, at least 31 people were killed, more than 200 others wounded in early morning explosions in cities across the country. 20 cars packed with explosives in different places. Let's go to northern Iraq and speak to Hiwa Osman, who is an Iraqi Kurdish journalist and blogs at Thoughts from Iraq. Hello, Hiwa. Welcome to the programme.
Hi, thank you.
And just give us your take on, well, first of all, the last couple of days in Iraq. What have things been like?
Well, it has been quite bloody given the previous period of lull, but it didn't come as a complete surprise, because in Iraq it has been the trend that with every political crisis, a bloody day follows. And we were all kind of waiting for that day to to take place, and we didn't quite know when. But I think every Iraqi and everybody who follows the situation in Iraq knew that a day like this is going to happen. It was only a matter of time. The coverage of that day, the media coverage of it, was quite substantive in Iraqi media. But as we noticed, the world coverage of it was just yet another bloody day in Iraq. And the event of the bombing of Boston, I think it was seen as, yes, a bomb went off in Boston. It was by Iraqi media, it was reported as an unusual event. And it took Iraqis by surprise, actually.
Bina Shah is live with us too from Karachi in Pakistan, a writer and columnist there. Hi there, Bina. Welcome to the programme.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Nice to speak to you. And there in Pakistan, at least 17 people were killed, many injured after a bomb attack in Peshawar. There's also elections coming up in Pakistan. And how do you feel, Bina, about the contrast in the prominence of Boston compared to an attack like that in Peshawar?
It's really, really hard not to draw comparisons. And one of the first things I noticed, I was on Twitter late in the night when the attacks happened in Boston, because of the time difference, it was very late at night. And immediately people in Pakistan were saying, oh, we're supposed to feel sorry for people in Boston. Look how many people they're killing in drone attacks here. So that response, I understood it, but I really had to restrain myself from chiming in with anything similar. I just felt it was the wrong time and the wrong kind of sentiment.
He were anything like that when people were responding in Iraq?
Well, I think Iraqis were too busy with that, with the Iraqi bloody day, to even notice or start drawing comparisons with Boston. I think the reporting of Boston, it was just that a bomb went off. I mean, to Iraqis, a bomb goes off every other day, and and it wasn't the. I didn't hear much from Iraqis about drawing comparisons, saying, oh, we are much worse off. A bomb is a bomb, wherever it goes off, I think. And a killed person by an act of terrorism is a killed person wherever he or she was. I think there was a much more, calmer reaction, I think, in Iraq to that, specifically in Iraq, that we hear next door in Syria, in other countries around us in the region, that terrorist acts goes on, daily killing takes place in these various countries. So really, it wasn't that much noticed by the Iraqis, to be honest.
Haider's our Pakistani guest in Boston, and you've got a point to make on this, Haider. Do you feel, or do you understand the ways in which news organisations have given relative prominence to these events?
When I was here and this sort of event happened, I reflected that if three people were to have died in a bomb attack in Karachi or in Peshawar, no one would have even blinked an eye. Maybe it wouldn't even have made the front news. But I think I understand why, and I think it makes complete sense that this should receive so much coverage just because of the context of where it has happened. First of all, it has happened in the United States. It's happened in Boston, a city that's naive to such an event. And what everyone worries about, and this is something that David had touched upon earlier, is that the fallout from something like this, even though if you look at the raw numbers, three people died, the fallout of this for possibly a large Muslim country such as Pakistan could be immense. This killer would, if this terrorist were to be found to be of Pakistani origin, people who are studying here on visas, people who are applying for scholarships, parents who want to visit their families. And then you think about other things on a national level, such as could sanctions come into place? We're already under a lot of drone strikes. Could those go up in number? So I think all of that, because of the context of where this happened, how this happened, and what previous reaction from American governments have been to such attacks, I think that's why the coverage of this actually does make sense.
Can I make a point here? I'd like to respond to that, actually, if I may.
You may, Bina. The floor is yours. Go ahead.
The reason that I felt very hesitant and, in fact, a little dismayed by people making those comparisons is that in the hours after the bomb blast, nobody knew, and we still don't know who was responsible for it. And I didn't want to see people saying, well, drone attack equals a response in the name of, you know, those poor drone victims, and therefore the Boston Marathon is linked. I wanted to say, no, we don't know anything. The perpetrator of the Boston Marathon bombings may have nothing to do with what's happening in our country. So what? And I saw a lot of reaction, in fact, from Americans who responded to a blog posting that I did. And they were, in fact, saying, no, we need to pay attention. We need to understand what we're doing over there is upsetting people. It's as devastating for them as this is for us. And I appreciate that coming from the American public itself. I appreciate it, and I think the point is much better made when it's Americans sitting up and saying, hey, we realize this is bringing it closer to home for us, and now we have some empathy for what people are going through over there.
Renia is listening to us in Accra in Ghana, posting on our Facebook page, all life's precious. I'm not downplaying Monday's events in any way whatsoever, but many people die every day in Iraq, Afghanistan, Burma, Nigeria, Somalia, Pakistan, etc., etc., with little more than a passing mention. More balance is needed, says Renia. Thank you very much indeed for being in touch. Stanley makes this point from London. The Boston Marathon was an international event represented by many countries worldwide. It was right to be given so much coverage. It was sad news. Now, and Afghanistan was mentioned just then. We'll go to Kabul in just one moment. But first of all, let's go to Damascus in Syria, where we can speak to Tabat Salim, who is a journalist there. Hi, Tabat. Welcome to World Have Your Say. How do you feel about the prominence of a bomb attack in Boston compared to that of Syria on the same day and the last couple of days in the news?
Well, actually, it was a big question mark in the minds of the Syrians here. Why that big fuss was made about the death of three people. Of course, when at first, when everybody knew about it at the very beginning, there was a keen interest to know what's going on. This could be understood. But the fact that death toll in Syria is 10 sometimes, if not 50 times more every day, there is this question in the minds of the Syrians, and this is a big campaign of comments on Facebook, etc., about this. Why the Syrians are let down? I think the reason behind this is that the Syrians see that nobody gives a damn about what's going on in this country. It's a keen sense of frustration, maybe, is the reason. So I think, well, it is a valid and legitimate question to be raised, why there is a big, and the Western world is killed, that big fuss we have, but while about 150 persons are killed a day here, and nobody cares, and it has become a routine thing.
Maybe so why do you think it is? Do you think it is because it is so routine that it's happening so much that it gets progressively less attention?
This could be, but again, but this is not the only reason. The only reason is that nothing has been done at all, even no serious attempts to put an end to this bloodshed here. So, as I said, it is a keen sense of frustration which raises questions about this, while in fact, even if one person is dead, it should be condemned regardless. But again, I think it is the reason is because the Syrians feel they are let down.
And let me just interrupt there just one moment. And yes, you certainly can make a point in response to that. He were in a sec. I just want to bring you some more reports on the Boston bombing investigation. And I mentioned just before the 12:30 news that media reports in the US were saying investigators believe they'd identified a suspect in the marathon bombing. One report saying that the authorities had an image of the suspect carrying a bag at one of the bomb sites. And we, the BBC, unable to confirm those reports. They were being reported by CNN and also the Boston Globe. CNN is now also reporting and quoting their sources in law enforcement that investigators have arrested a suspect. Now, again, not something the BBC can independently verify so far, but that's what CNN is saying at the moment. The BBC will be taking a look at those reports and seeing if we can substantiate them. But I just thought I'd bring you that. Hiwa, go ahead. You're wanting to make a point in response to Tabet.
I mean, as you as you just did, I think the news value of the event is so high for many news editors in many newsrooms around the world that makes it important on the news agenda. These days, we have been working on Iraqi news, on news of bombs in Iraq for over 10 years now. And I think 10 years of the same story being repeated will eventually become boring for the audience. And the news business is all about the audience at the end of the day. And a news story like the Boston bombing is not so much about the number of people killed as much as it is about the news value of that event and its importance for people across the globe. I think every single country in the world is waiting to see the identity of the suspect or the perpetrator in order to see what the reaction of America will be to that, or what America will do. And they have seen in the past what America can do if a country or a group tries to attack America. And so that's why I don't think it is correct, with all due respect to everybody to all the victims of terror around the world. I think the value of this news event is not in the three people who were killed. It is in the event itself and the nature of it and the fact that the importance of that event to so many audiences. We often in newsrooms just weigh news items or news stories by the number of people who are interested in the story, and certainly a much larger number of people were interested in the Boston bombing around the world on Monday than those who were interested in the 30 or 40 people who were killed in Iraq.
And Hiwa, you're in northern Iraq. We've heard from Syria and Pakistan too. Let's go to Afghanistan and speak to Lotfullah Najafizadeh, who's a Kabul-based journalist working for Tolo Television. Hi, Lotfullah. Welcome to the programme. Seven people died in a roadside bombing, seven civilians in the west of Afghanistan today, with women and children reported among the dead. Just pick up from what our other guests were saying. Is it the case sometimes that you realise that such horrible events, because you're covering them so regularly, no longer have such a capacity to shock?
I think that's true. What happened in Boston had more coverage than the 24 Afghans who were killed in the past 24 hours in this country. That's mainly because the Afghans think it would be another opportunity for the Americans to reconsider the war on terror, and that would affect, you know, the Afghan mission and the other war on terror missions in the region. The reactions, you know, we were getting from the ordinary Afghans today was that if the Americans cannot fight against the terrorism in their sanctuaries, the consequences would be that they have to fight it, you know, in their own streets, back in their major cities, such as Boston. So that's true that, you know, this incident had an extensive coverage. Our channel, you know, we were having guests from all over the world, including the U.S., who were talking about it, and how would it impact the U.S. mission in Afghanistan, especially now that they're leaving. President Obama has said a couple of times in the past year or so that terrorist organizations such as Al-Qaeda have lost the momentum. You know, they are on the verge of defeat. We still don't know whether there's any association with groups such as Al-Qaeda. But again, this is another, I think, indication that terrorism can hurt the U.S., and that would, I think, that would damage some sort of international relations countries are having with the United States, and would impact the U.S. war on terror mission in many countries, including Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Lot Fuller in Kabul, thank you very much for your contribution. Thanks also to Bina in Pakistan, Tabet in Damascus and Hiwa in Iraq. And all of our guests, Stuart's posted from the United States on Facebook. As an American, I felt guilty feeling worse about the 3 deaths in Boston than the 36 deaths that same day in Iraq when bombs were simultaneously set off throughout their country. The truth is that attacks that hit places you or your family are likely to visit are harder to dismiss and are therefore pushed to our mental forefront. You can carry on that discussion at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. And stay tuned to the BBC for any further developments in the investigation in Boston.
With bbc.com/news, you get the latest news stories anytime you like. Whether you're interested in science, health, technology or business, the bbc.com/news website can offer it all. It also gives you the opportunity to listen live to our news output or check the latest breaking news with our minute-by-minute news feed. All this content, coverage and opportunity makes the BBC the world leader in news coverage online. bbc.com/news.
The BBC in Naples.
Tel Aviv.
Perth.
Accra.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.